Now this afternoon we're going to look at these steps of engagement in marriage. When is the time for engagement? The time for engagement is when both parties are settled that it is God's will for them to join together in life and in the Lord's work. You notice my emphasis on the word both and the word settled. Sometimes we see an experience where one of the parties is strong-willed and is fully settled that this is the thing to do. The other party may not be so strong-willed and may be lacking in personal conviction. And sometimes there is an overriding of the weaker will by the stronger will. This is most unfortunate. The stronger the convictions of one of the parties, the more there should be not merely a willingness, but a desire to wait for equally clear convictions on the part of the other. Anything less than this is not only selfish, it's silly. I mean foolish. Because believe me, if there is uncertainty before the marriage vows are taken, the door is wide open for the devil to come in afterward and sow the seeds of doubt and uncertainty all through the married life. So I repeat, the time for engagement is when both parties are settled that this is God's will. And this, of course, includes all these other steps that we've studied. It includes getting counsel at every step. It includes keeping close to counselors during the courtship time. I have run into experiences where young people who are even trying to follow these principles seem to have the idea that once the consent of the parents on both sides was obtained for courtship, that after that it's entirely up to the young people. But a Christian young man will want the counsel of his parents and his other God-given counselors just as much during courtship as before courtship. He needs it just as much. If the young man himself is to be weighing matters, he needs all the help he can get from those of wider experience and longer experience. And the same with the young woman. I know of an experience where the young people felt that they had the approval of the parents on both sides, but later one or two of the parents involved indicated a strong disapproval of the match. But because they had had at one time the approval of all the parents concerned to begin courtship or to carry it on, why they felt they had complied with the technicalities. And that, of course, is overlooking what's involved in this thing. That is our need of counsel. And after all, if the young people during courtship are free to change their minds, certainly the parents on each side ought to be. If the evidence is not complete at the beginning, there ought to be opportunity to examine the evidence as time goes on. So the doubt of either one, or of the counselors, the parents particularly, of either one, should delay the engagement, because the engagement is a settled promise. That now we've looked at the whole thing from every standpoint. We believe, as far as human beings can know, that this is God's will, and so we are pledged to each other. But a word previous to engagement. At any time during courtship, the negative conviction of either of the parties should terminate the courtship. Expressed in words of less syllables, that simply means that if either the young man or the young woman says no, that ought to stop the thing right now. there ought to be no making pain and sorrow and trial by the other party trying to keep at it and continue it and all that sort of thing. This is unreasonable. Either party has the privilege any time during the courtship of saying, "Friend, we have reached the point where, as far as I know, this is not God's will. So, this is the end, and God bless you as you continue your life for Him. And I know He'll bless me as I continue my life, but this is the end." And may I say, friends, if Christian courtship has been carried on in a Christian way, that ought to be possible without making enemies. If the courtship was entered into for the sincere purpose of finding out God's will, then if either one of them finds out that the will is no, then the object of the courtship has been attained. The object was to find out what God's will is. Is it always yes? Well, if it is, we don't need any courtship much, do we? No. Since the object is to find out if it is God's will, I repeat, at any point in the courtship, if one party or the other says, "No, God isn't leading in this," the other party will have to accept that. They should accept it, whether they can see it or not. After all, it takes two to make this kind of a union, doesn't it? And the convictions, the conscience of each one must be fully satisfied. Not only that, but according to references we've already read, the negative counsel, the negative convictions of God-fearing parents on either side should bring an end to it. Let's review that reference. Adventist Home, page 75. "Should parents, you ask, select a companion without regard to the mind or feelings of son or daughter? I put the question to you as it should be. Should a son or daughter select a companion without first consulting the parents? And should that child, notwithstanding the counsel and entreaties of his parents, persist in following his own course? I answer decidedly, no, not if he never marries. The fifth commandment forbids such a course." Now, turn please to 48 of Adventist Home, and I want you to notice that according to the inspired blueprint, while an engagement is to be considered binding, there are times when it's proper to break an engagement. You'll find that in the last two paragraphs on page 48. You'll read there the circumstances under which engagements not only may be broken, they should be broken. If during the engagement period, previous to the marriage, either party arrives at the conviction that this isn't God's will, if they've been deceived, or if with clearer light they see that they've made a mistake, they shouldn't feel, "Oh, well, I've given my promise and I've got to go ahead with it." That's a pitiful way to begin a home. Now, if they have true love for each other, unselfishness will lead them to break the promise if it's contrary to the will of God and say, "I'm glad we're finding it out now instead of later on." Read what it says there. I won't take time to read it, but it's very clear. There are times to cancel the engagement. But marriage is the great divide. Once that has been entered into, there's no turning back. Engagement, there's still opportunity to turn back, but not marriage. That's settled when those vows have been taken before men and angels. Forsaking all others, they will keep themselves only each to the other as long as they both shall live. When that's all settled at the marriage altar, friends, no turning back. So all these other steps, including the period of engagement, are periods of counsel and prayer. But engagement means, as far as we know this is God's will, we're settled, we're going to make our plans. Now, I want to spend a little time with you this afternoon on the wedding itself. You know the difference between wedding and marriage, don't you? Wedding has to do with the ceremony in which people enter into marriage. Turn over to Isaiah, the 62nd chapter and the 5th verse. Here's a beautiful statement. Isaiah 62, verse 5. I love it. The last part, last three lines of the verse. As the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. Is a marriage a time of rejoicing? According to this verse, the bridegroom indeed rejoices over the bride. And God, notice, uses this as an illustration, a symbol, representing the great joy that he has in bringing home his people to his Father's house. Oh, friends, it's a wonderful thing when a Christian wedding can be the representation of the joy of the Lord in taking his people home to the New Jerusalem. Adventist Home, page 100. The middle of the page, a joyous occasion. Speaking of the marriage at Cana, where Christ performed his first miracle, the scriptures state that both Jesus and his disciples were called to this marriage feast. Christ has given Christians no sanction to say when invited to a marriage, we ought not to be present on so joyous an occasion. By attending this feast, Christ taught that he would have us rejoice with those who do rejoice in the observance of his statutes. He never discouraged the innocent festivities of mankind when carried on in accordance with the laws of heaven. So is it possible to have a joyous wedding that Christ can attend, that he will attend? Is it? Oh, yeah. As the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. And yet, notice, just on the next page, we have something to balance this. I have heard this reference quoted that I have just read to justify a lot more than the reference covers. A joyous occasion is far from being a mirthful occasion. An extravagant occasion, an occasion for pride and display. Notice as we cover this now. 101, second paragraph. It has always seemed so very inappropriate to me to see the marriage ordinance associated with hilarity and glee and a pretense of something. No, it is an ordinance ordained by God to be looked upon with the greatest solemnity. Now let's put these two pages together. Page 100 says, a joyous occasion. This says, the greatest solemnity. Can you get those together? Well, until you have those two together, you don't have the picture. It's like having your eyes in focus. Some of us have to have glasses so we can get our eyes in focus. And that's why God has given us the spirit of prophecy, so that we can get our spiritual eyesight in focus. And so we have here these wonderful statements calling us, on the one hand, to a view of the wedding, which is one of joy and rejoicing. On the other hand, one of solemnity. Now, it's been my privilege to participate in a good many weddings from various standpoints. And I've also witnessed a few that I haven't participated in. And I've witnessed a few that I wouldn't participate in under any circumstances. There are weddings and there are weddings. And so I want to spend a few minutes with you this afternoon on some of the instruction on this matter. On this matter of having a wedding which is one of joy and yet of sacred solemnity, think of baptism. When we open the baptismal waters and candidates are brought down into the watery grave and buried and brought up, and we have our prayer and our singing and all this. Do you agree with me it is a joyous occasion? Oh, yes. Nothing more joyous in the life of the Christian than a beautiful baptismal service. And yet, while it's very joyful, it's a sacred, solemn ordinance, isn't it? Not a time for throwing rice or throwing paper or having some tin cans around or making a lot of noise or cracking a lot of jokes or anything of the kind. Neither is it a time for a lot of display. We don't dress up the baptismal candidates with finery that costs anywhere from $100 to $1,000 a piece, do we? I wonder why. Isn't baptism the greatest moment of life? Isn't it? Yeah. Now notice how we are warned by this same gift of prophecy against display and extravagance in the wedding service. Volume 4, page 503. Now this is the chapter that I was quoting from in our last lesson. I'll start here at the beginning of the chapter. We are living in the last days when the mania upon the subject of marriage constitutes one of the signs of the near coming of Christ. There's a what? A mania on the subject of marriage. And it constitutes one of the signs of the coming of Christ. God is not consulted in these matters. Religion, duty, and principle are sacrificed to carry out the promptings of the unconsecrated heart. There should be no great display and rejoicing over the union of the parties. Now, this statement, standing by itself, would seem to rule out rejoicing, but you notice it's a rejoicing that's linked with what? Display. And balanced by the other statement, we can see from Adventist home, there is a type of rejoicing which is suitable, but it's one linked with simplicity and sacred solemnity. But here we have a rejoicing that is linked with great display. And this is not to be. Now, in the same volume, page 515, and a quotation from this page you will find in Adventist Home, page 101. And since you have that open before you, notice the first paragraph on Adventist Home, page 101. There is no reason why we should make great parade or display, even if the parties were perfectly suited to each other. Now, this is in the midst of a general testimony to the church at Battle Creek. And I want to tell you something interesting in the background of this. I, in the providence of God, have a copy of a little book called Testimonies for the Physicians and Helpers of the Sanitarium. This was printed in Battle Creek before any of us were born. And these are testimonies that were given back in 1878 and 79. And this chapter in Volume 4 that I'm reading from here is part of what's here. But this is the original testimony as printed back there at Battle Creek for circulation in the Battle Creek Church. And it has some things of local interest and application, including the names of people that the prophet was talking about. So I'm going to give you the background to this statement here in Volume 4, crying out against fashionable weddings and display. She wasn't talking about the people in China or New York City. She was talking about Seventh-day Adventists in Battle Creek. And Battle Creek was the headquarters of our work. You notice when you read this in Volume 4, page 515, she says there have been marriage relations formed in Battle Creek with which God has had nothing to do. And this is where, and in this setting, she says there is no reason why we should make great parade or display, even if the parties were perfectly suited to each other, but that remains to be tested. When those who profess to be reformers, those in humble life, ape the customs and fashions of the worldly wealthy, it is a reproach to our faith. Now, this from my little book, page 77. Sister Lamson was the general matron of the Battle Creek Sanitarium. Sister Lamson's advice and influence has had a tendency to weaken the barriers which separate the people of God from the world. The display of fashionable dress on the occasion of Dr. Kellogg's marriage was a telling discourse in favor of departing from principle. So one of the outstanding leaders in the Battle Creek Church and in the Seventh-day Adventist Church had just had a wedding there. And the prophet of God was called upon to reprove and rebuke for the display of fashionable dress at that wedding. This is the setting of this statement in Volume 4 that we're reading. The display of fashionable dress on the occasion of Dr. Kellogg's marriage was a telling discourse in favor of departing from principle. Many lectures upon reform could not counteract the evil influence which was thus exerted. We have had to meet it everywhere. This display was made by Sister Lamson's advice. Now back to Volume 4, 515, talking about this very thing. She says, when those who profess to be reformers, those in humble life, ape the customs and fashions of the worldly wealthy, it is a reproach to our faith. There are some to whom God gave the word of warning, but did that stop them? No, they did not fear God, for the bewitching power of Satan was upon them. It must have been something to be a member of the remnant church when the living prophet was here, and your name might be read off as somebody that had gotten out of line. Would you like to be in a church like that? I predict that if you remain with the remnant church, you'll see some things like this again. We need the living testimony in the church, dear friends. And if we'll dig out what's in these books and follow them, God may be pleased to give us, if we need any additional bringing us into line, He'll do it. My point is, these references are clear, that there should be no fashionable display in connection with these weddings. Now, why not? What's a wedding for anyway? What's its purpose? I'll tell you this, friends. If the marriage has been inspired by Hollywood, Hollywood will be a good place to pattern after for the wedding. But if we've been looking to the sanctuary as our inspiration, Hollywood can't help us much. What do you say? Yes. Now, in the ancient sanctuary, which was copied after the tabernacle in heaven, and which is to be a model for us as we set up Christian homes, you remember it was not enough that the sanctuary be built. There must be a priest to minister there, and that priest must be anointed. Look up in Exodus the ceremonies on the anointing of the priest. See how God indicated that He must give His approval of those who would minister in the holy places. My dear friends, if I understand it, a Christian wedding means that we're bringing two young people to God. They're dedicating themselves to God and to each other, and we are uniting in prayer with them and for them, that God will anoint them with His Spirit and make it possible for them to have a heaven on earth. Can you think of anything greater than that? Would you want any less? No. And so if we have that concept, all eyes will be directed not to human beings, but to God. The music will be not, "Here comes the bride," with all eyes strained to see her in all her regalia. No, no. In a simple Christian wedding, both the bride and the bridegroom, and the families of both, and all the visitors, if they're Christians, will be thinking, "Dear Lord, we have come on this solemn yet joyous occasion, this joyous yet solemn occasion, that these young people may dedicate themselves to God and to each other, may recite their vows and pledge their lives to God and to each other. And we are here to pray with them and for them that God will anoint them by His Spirit. Because unless God does that, where will there be fire on the altar? Where will there be light in the sanctuary? It takes a miracle of God to kindle that fire. And oh, if we understand this, dear people, we would no more go through the ceremony of a wedding without our sense of a great need than we would go through a baptismal ceremony, thinking that merely putting people in the water and out again was the great thing. Do you see? Oh, it's a wonderful thing, friends. When that spirit of solemnity, that spirit of dedication, that spirit of simplicity, which is in the baptismal service, can be in the wedding service.